All right, we're in John chapter 7. John chapter 7, and we're in verse 19. We looked at the last week, I was on this, just the idea of him saying, well, none of you keep the law. And that's a pretty brassy statement to make to a bunch of Pharisees who pride themselves on keeping the law. And of course, we looked at that, the idea that, yes, they kept the law in the sense of the outward things of the law, the things you can measure, the things you can look at, the things you can touch. What the Pharisees couldn't do was keep the inward things of the law. Okay? The Apostle Paul said, if it had not been for thou shalt not covet, I wouldn't know what lust was. But it was that idea that a commandment said, thou shalt not covet. I learned what lust was. I learned what it was to covet. And that's really where the sin was. The sin wasn't in what he touched, what he looked at, anything else. Jesus Christ had said, if you lust after a woman in your heart, you're guilty. If I were to put a cage here and exhibit a Siberian tiger in that cage, and, I've just finished reading the biography of William Carey, and I read a biography of him written back in the 1800s by a man very familiar with a lot of his Confederates and such, William Carey being the man who opened up Baptist missions. He's the one who had the vision in England to go to India and to preach to those people. And it was such a novel thought, the idea, those heathen people from India? Yeah, the heathen people from India. And he went there and he preached amongst them. It took him 7 years to get his first convert. But the man who was his, a man by the name of Krishna Pal, was the first man to be converted. And he became a great hymn writer of hymns in the Bengali language and a great preacher in his own right and such. And but in reading that, it's talking about when Carey first went to India, he had to find employment. And so he worked as kind of a manager on a plantation. And a bunch of the people from India moved around him because they knew it was a European with a gun and therefore they'd be safer. And in 1 year, 20 workmen were carried off by tigers. All right, that gives you an idea what life was like there and the superstition of the Hindus thinking we can't touch those animals and such. So if I had one of those tigers and I had them in a cage right there, and let's say for the first few weeks the tiger's in there, he's trying to go, and after a while he realized, I can't get out of this cage. You walk by it, look at it, taunt it, do whatever. It's not even going to hardly open its eyes at you anymore. Have we changed its nature? No. All we've done is changed its habits. We haven't changed its nature. Its nature is still what it was. And that's what Phariseeism did to the human being. It put a cage around him, but it didn't change his nature. All it did is put a cage around him where now he's still what he is on the inside. And every once in a while, the cage breaks and that comes out. It's those moments of anger you have that show the real you. Not that practiced thing, never mind the little man behind the curtain. Look at me, the great Oz, and such. And so that's the average person, is they have this public projection that we put out there. This is what I really am. No, that's not what you really are. What you really are those little moments that escape once in a while that you're really trying not to let anyone see what you really are. And that's the crux of the gospel, is trying to get people to understand themselves as God sees them. If I were to walk by that tiger, I'm not going to be mistaken for what that is. I can see straight through that cage. God sees straight through the heart. God sees what that person really is. He's not fooled but for 5 seconds about it. So the thing is, he told the Pharisees, none of you keep the law. Oh, how offensive to them. They're in this cage called Phariseeism. we're perfect in here. Uh-huh. Until such time as your Messiah comes, you end up killing him because they coveted. All right. So the thing is, he says again in verse 19, did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keepeth the law? Why go you about to kill me? Now watch this. Verse 20, the people answered and said, thou hast a devil. Who goeth about to kill thee? Okay. And we're going to see that within three verses, they're going to be asking, isn't this the man everybody wants to kill? One of the sufferings of Jesus Christ, and it's listed in the book of Hebrews, is it says he suffered the contradiction of sinners against himself. What's that mean? Well, how many times have you ever heard somebody talking to you, maybe putting you down or lecturing you or talking about one of your faults or something, and as they're doing it, you're looking at that person thinking, this person? And you're thinking of all the statements they've made, all the things they've done that are just like what they're accusing you of. And that's listed as one of the sufferings of Jesus Christ. That's not a light thing to put up with. It's listed, you know, when we put the scourgings and the nails and all those things, that's one of the things in the list. As if you were to take everything in that Bible that he suffered. So the thing is, here's one of those places, the contradiction of sinners against himself. Okay. Oh, who goes about to kill you? He's got a devil saying that. Within three, four verses. Isn't this the man they want to kill? You know? It's always amazing how quickly people will change. George Orwell wrote a very famous book years ago called Animal Farm. And it used to be, in my day, all kids had to read Animal Farm. And now most people don't know what Animal Farm is, but it was a mockery of the Russian Revolution. And when George Orwell wrote it, the big thing in England at that time is if you were a leftist is to love Russia. When World War II was over, all our atomic secrets, all our top state secrets were sent out by the Yale and the Princeton boys thinking that Stalin was so wonderful, and they sent him all this stuff. And the same thing happened in England. The Oxford and the Eton boys all sent it to him and thought it was so good. Stalin called them useful idiots. Uh-huh. That was his phrase for them. They're useful idiots. And they just thought that they did well in what they did. They thought that was all the good thing to do. And so George Orwell, who was no friend of the Bible or anything, wrote the book called Animal Farm, in which all the animals take the farm over. And they make a rule that two legs are bad, four legs are good. Everybody has to chant that and such. And then the chickens are upset, and then because they only have two legs, but it's ruled their wings are like legs. And so it goes on. It gets more and more complex as it goes. But when it finally ends up, the pigs have taken the farm over, and the other animals are looking in the window, and the pigs are standing now on two legs, eating with the men from the town and talking with them and selling the animals, just like the farmers used to do that they chased out. And it's a parody of the Russian Revolution, what eventually happened. Fidel Castro died as one of the most wealthy men on earth. You just could never measure it. They know it was in billions and billions of dollars that he had personally and such. But it was that George Orwell thing. So the thing is, all through that book, Animal Farm, as it's going on, they're slowly, slightly changing the slogans each time. And some of the animals are figuring out the slogans are getting changed. But if you watch American politics and American culture, that same thing's going on. Yeah. Four legs good, two legs bad. I'll say that a lot sometimes to people that are, of leftist bent or whatever. And most of them don't even know what it means anymore. They're wholly ignorant and no idea what literature is or anything else. If it wasn't for MSNBC, they wouldn't have an opinion. And, it's just what they are and such. But it's the same thing here. where people go ahead and they're all in a crowd and they have opinions of Jesus, but nobody really knows what's going on. And you'll find that in the book of Acts, riots take off. And it says everybody comes together, but nobody knows why. You know, they're just doing it. My boys have a lot of fun. They go on, and there's a couple of people they follow on YouTube. And one of them is a guy who wanders into college protests and interviews the protesters. And you'll just hold your sides laughing because he'll get them to agree with what they're protesting against. They don't know. They're just there. P.J. O'Rourke wrote a book some 30 years ago called The Chick Factor. Basically, whichever side is the prettiest girls, that's the one where all the guys join. And he proved it. He wasn't just making a mockery. He really proved it. You know, the prettiest girls on campus all go for such. All the guys are there and they're for it and such. It's called the chick factor. They don't know what they're talking about. But this is what Jesus is running into here. And it's nothing new that we're going on with here in the 21st century. It's been going on as long as men have ever congregated together. All right. Now, verse 21, Jesus answered and said unto them, I have done one work, and ye all marvel. And they did. Moses, therefore, gave unto you circumcision, not because it was of Moses, but of the fathers. And ye on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. So the question is, now he's just healed someone, and they're all upset, because he did on the Sabbath. Now, there's a couple observations I want to make. I have been accused before of provoking people. And there's times I've provoked people. You know what the Pharisees asked? They said, isn't it reasonable you just wait a day to heal? You know, if a guy's been 37 years with the palsy, what would it hurt to wait one day to heal him? Okay? Jesus did it in their face. He provoked them. He couldn't have come there a day before. Couldn't have told the guy, hey, show up here at 6 tonight when Sabbath is over. Everybody show up. And I'll no, he just healed them. In other words, he did it in their face. He provoked them. And I'll be honest, I've also had times when I've provoked people, then I was nothing but a jerk. When I look back on it, there's no excuse for what I did other than being a jerk and trying to trumpet myself and make myself some great thing. And it takes a lot of wisdom to know when do you step out and do something and when don't you. And you really, I'll tell you this, you need the clear leading of God when you do something like that. Peter Cartwright, one of my great heroes of the faith, he left that great, in 1858, as an old man, they asked him to write his autobiography. It's called The Autobiography of Peter Cartwright. And if you want to know what it was like to be a Methodist circuit rider, he was ordained by Bishop Asbury himself somewhere around 1803. And when he writes his autobiography in 1858, he says, today there are now well over 1 million Methodists in the West. By the West, he meant pretty well up to the Mississippi River, maybe a little bit over. And he said, there were 600 of us sent out. And he said, not a one of us was a literate man. By that meaning having education. They could all read and write. He said, not one of us was a literate man. But we have added 1 million people to the Methodist Church in what we've done. Peter Cartwright would sit there and fist fight with a logger, knock the guy on the ground, sit on his chest, and preach the gospel to him. Okay? Didn't bother him. And talks about one time they're having a Methodist revival and in the woods, and some ruffians decide they want to break it up. And they come in and they're shouting and shooting their guns and people are weeping, oh, why did God allow this? And Peter Cartwright said, I don't think he will allow it. He waded into the bunch of them and fought with his fists. And when it's all said, some of the other guys did. And when it's all said and done, guys are laying around bleeding and he's dragging them out into the woods and such. And then everybody's weeping, oh, we can't go on and preach. And I said, oh, I can. Got up and preached. And just Peter Cartwright. And it was just the times and what it was. But he talked about an incident in which he came in, and what he would do was this, the old Methodist circuit riders. He came into an area, and you might find a cabin, and it might be literally 10 miles before there's another cabin. And he'd come to that cabin, and he'd say, look, I'm a Methodist preacher. May I stay here tonight? Well, no one ever didn't allow you to stay in a cabin. And so he says, but I would like tonight to sing a few psalms and to preach from the Word of God. Will you allow me to do that? Of course they would. These are people who haven't heard a church service in years. They'd say, do you have any neighbors nearby? Usually they'd send their kids off, you know, 15, 20 miles or something. And there might be five or six neighbors who are able to come that night. And then he would schedule time, say, I will be back there in 6 weeks. And when he came back in 6 weeks, they're all waiting. I mean, there's 100 people who haven't heard a preacher in this period of time. They're waiting for him, and he would organize then a Methodist church in that area, and he would get it going. Well, he talked about coming into one place, and there was a barn, and there was a store, and even a couple of houses around, which is a huge community out in western Indiana and Illinois and such at that time. And he said, I would like to, you know, to stay here tonight. And they said, well, you probably don't want to. We're going to have a dance tonight. And he said, no, he said, I would stay here. So he said that night in the barn, you know, a bunch of people came. He said there was probably 50, 60 people that came. He said there were jugs of corn liquor around and a man with a fiddle, and they began dancing. And he said, I sat there, not quite sure why God had me there. And he said, a woman came up to me and said, sir, would you dance? And he said, ma'am, I don't do anything without prayer first. And he took her by the hand, led her into the middle of the dance floor, got down on his knees, brought her down on her knees. She's screaming and yelling to get away, and he began to pray at the top of his lungs for her and for everyone in there. A revival broke out. People began to weep. These are different people than us. These are people who knew they were doing wrong. They just had never had a chance to do right. Later on, he said, you know, that wasn't like me. He said, as bold as I think I am, that was unusual. And he said, I've thought about it many times why I did that. And he said, first of all, I thought about it and thought, these people, the reason they're doing what they're doing isn't because they've hardened their hearts against God. They've just never had a chance to do anything else. They weren't here because of a conscious decision. I don't like God. These Methodists are idiots and all this kind of stuff. And he said, I look back on it, and he said, even as I write it, I'm amazed at what I did that time. But he said, I know that God was in it. And if you'll stay filled with the Spirit of God, maybe once or twice in your life, you will have such an opportunity for something. For me, it was the time when I met Dale and Amy. That's not normally me. They're yelling at me from the driveway. Who are you? I'm your pastor. We don't have a pastor. You do now. And up the driveway I went. And that's not, you just have to know, that's not normally me. That is unusual for me. But I had prayed for those people. This was my chance. I knew that God had sent me over to those people. I knew that. When I left, they were both crying, sitting there in their chairs and crying. And it still took a long time for me to come to church or whatever else. But you won't find anybody else in this area that I've ever talked to that way. Just an unusual thing. So again, with Jesus Christ, it's a matter of when it came to healing on the Sabbath, he provoked. There's no doubt about it. Everything the Pharisees said, you could have waited a day, and done it, and he could have. He could have told them all, which man who having the palsy or having leprosy or blind wouldn't wait 3 or 4 hours to get healed? Okay? But you know what? Jesus Christ provoked. All right. So it goes on, and he says this, verse 22 again. Moses therefore gave unto you circumcision, not because it is of Moses, but of the fathers. And ye on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. If a man on the Sabbath day receive circumcision, that the law of Moses should not be broken, are ye angry at me because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day? Now, I'll tell you something fascinating here. When Avi Gold reads the New Testament, and again, Avi Gold is a dedicated Jew, an absolute conservative Jew who when he reads rabbinical writings, he'll read one 3,000 years old, one 100 years old. They're all written in Hebrew. He's known Hebrews as long as he's lived. Master of many languages, that's irrelevant to what I'm saying here. But the thing is, absolute dedicated Jew who won't email. He won't do anything on the Sabbath. He won't drive in a motor car on the Sabbath. He won't turn a light switch on the Sabbath. He won't cook on the Sabbath. Anything of that sort. He's done that his entire life. When he was here, one of our problems was is getting him kosher food, you know, making sure that he had stuff that he could eat. We had to have new pans for him. We couldn't have anything that, you know, Gentiles had ever eaten bad food out of or anything of that sort. When he reads the New Testament, he's angry with the Pharisees of that day. He agrees with Jesus Christ. I'm going to give you one of the reasons, and it has to do with two words in the English language. One of them is work, and the other is labor. Thou shalt do no work on the Sabbath, but you're allowed to do labor. They're two different Hebrew words. And your King James translators translated them, according to Avi, absolutely perfectly, like the Hebrew. Labor and work are separated as two different things. Here's what the definition is. Work is when you change something from one thing to another. I have a board here. I want to make it into a table. Okay? And so when you're done, it's become a table. That was work. But let's say that you have a table that's dirty and you wipe it off. You haven't made it into something new. That was labor. Okay? So it's been ruled by the rabbinicals that to flip a light switch, work is actually going on, therefore a Jew won't do it. To Avi, nothing's more agonizing than coming into his hotel room when he's in a strange place and find out they turned his lights off. He can't turn them back on, okay? So he's just going to have to be in that room in the dark until such time as 6 o'clock in the evening comes on Saturday. He usually leaves notes in that, please do not change any switches. He's done all that. The Jews actually have food that they prepare and traditional Jewish food that cooks a long time and will be ready on the Sabbath where they did the work the day before. And, you know, now it's sitting there and ready for them and hot on the Sabbath and such. And those are all traditional things. So what Jesus Christ is telling them here, he agrees with this. In other words, I didn't change this person. I healed this person. Even today in Israel, he said, in his neighborhoods, and there are neighborhoods that where this type of Jew will live. And in those neighborhoods, if you see a light come on the Sabbath, they know there's a medical emergency. And they'll all say, oh my goodness, so-and-so, there's a problem there. Because a light came on, and that's the one time you're allowed during medical emergencies. And then an ambulance will show up there or something that... And they actually have jokes and say, well, turn the light on, better call the ambulance. So the neighbors will think you're just, you know. but it's again, Jesus Christ is making these fine distinctions here that the Jews do today. So when you read this, you'll understand he's not breaking their law. He's actually taking their law and being very fine-tuned with it. We actually have on our website, if you go back and look under Avi Gold, special meetings, I think is where he's under, he actually teaches on that, and he says this. He says, basically, the rule is the tabernacle is their measurement. If you go back and see what they had to do to make the tabernacle, anything that would mimic anything they did in making the tabernacle is forbidden on the Sabbath. That's forbidden, okay? And it was a tremendous message that he did. He went through it and such. I got a hold of our Jewish missionaries and told them, you know, you really ought to listen to this. Not that you're going to necessarily agree with it, but you understand the mind of the conservative Jew. See, if you go to Rochester today and you pull all the Jews together, most of them don't live Judaism. It's just like if you went to Cuba and got everybody that calls themselves a Christian, if you're downtown Cuba. How many of them live a Christian life? Very few, but if they wouldn't do it on the census, they'd write, I'm a Christian, okay? But it's nothing that would wash in heaven. And so the Jews have the same problem. They have tons of people who call themselves Jews, but you only have a very small percentage of them who really are trying to make that work in the 21st century and do what they're supposed to. And they have their special neighborhoods, they have all that special kind of thing. And they're, in some ways, for me, easier to reach. Because when I teach them Moses, it stuns them. But for the Jewish missionaries, they're the hardest to reach. Because they see the Jewish missionary as genocide, somebody trying to wipe out what we do. Most of those Jews see, if you were to go on a tour bus in Israel today and tell one of those Jews, oh, I learned Hebrew in college, they would see you as anti-Semitic. Because the Hebrew taught in college is anti-Semitic. If you were to go, if you go to Bob Jones, go to Pensacola, go to Crown College, go to any of those, and you study Hebrew, you're actually learning under anti-Semites, and you don't know that. You're actually learning, for example, one of the popular Hebrew texts today used is done by a guy by the name of Kittel. It's Kittel's text. Kittel was the Nazis' theologian, personal friend of Adolf Hitler's, hated Jews. Dietrich. Another one, hated Jews. So they went to great lengths putting these texts out and such because they hated the Jews and they were trying to make these texts to get Christians away from the Jewish text and such. And so the single most popular lexicon of the Jewish language. In other words, if you were to call 1,000 fundamental preachers who are trying to learn Hebrew, or tried at one time, or fancy themselves to have stuff on there, the single most popular lexicon is Driver Briggs Brown Lexicon. Those men hated Jews. They hated them to the point that when they wanted to find the definition of a Hebrew word, they would go to the Quran and find out how Muhammad translated it. And that's what they would use. And said so. It's not a matter of us just so. They actually said that. So when you hear a Baptist preacher go, and the Hebrew on this really says this. No, he's telling you what Muhammad thinks the Hebrew means. He's not telling you what the Hebrew means. He's telling you what Muhammad thinks it means. So, and the Jews know that. So they see this wave of people coming over there as anti-Semitic. They see them as the next wave of the Nazis coming after them. They don't see them as, now if you take a guy who's just chewing bubble gum and he's a Jew in the sense the average American's a Christian, he doesn't know any of that. He doesn't know anything, right? You know, you get, and such. But when you're talking with those Jews who have sanctified their lives to Judaism, that's horror to them, all of that stuff. And Ashley's reading a book right now by Gail Ripley, and it's going pretty detailed. I mean, she's got it documented. It's there. And again, she's not just making stuff up. She's not just extrapolating. She's taking you to their writings and showing you what they said. This is what I've done. So when you go to the point you hate Jews so much that you go to the Arabic, because Arabic and Hebrew are sister languages, and see how Muhammad handled it, and put in all your definitions in that, and then you put out 50 years of preacher boys in America. Imagine what that's done to the United States. Boy, we'd probably have homosexuality everywhere. We'd probably have, you know, absolute liberals taken over. We'd probably have our institutions destroyed. That's probably what would happen, wouldn't it? Okay? You know why? Because the very salt of the earth got attacked. The very salt, the very thing that God expected to keep the nation, where you only had to have that teeny, that's all God asked for, was that teeny little bit to stay straight. But if the salt lost its saltiness, wherewith shall it be salted? Okay? And so the thing is, that's what Peter Cartwright was talking about back in 1858. He predicted the destruction of the Methodist Church, and he said, here's how they've done it. He said, from now on, he said, when I win a young man to the Lord and he gets called to preach, he said, the bonehead send him to a Bible college. And he said, it will be the destruction of our church. And it was. And those Bible colleges now have proved to be the destruction of fundamentalism in America. They weren't meant to be that, but they've proved to be that. They've gone ahead and done that. It's one of the things. Mike asked me a question the other day, and it was a good question. Just talking about different men who come by here. And if I have men by here, it's because usually because I believe in them. doesn't mean they have everything perfect. I don't have everything perfect. But he said, is there any help for some of them who are caught up in some of the nonsense that's going on in fundamentalism today? And yeah, there is. Some of those men have helped me out of some of that nonsense. And I have helped some of them out of some of that nonsense. Well, we've gone in there and they call me and say, boy, this is really refreshing. This has really helped me. Boy, I really see this different, you know, and such. And so I look around and ask myself, what churches do we have out there where people could really say to themselves, we want to do something different. We want to break out of that. We want to get out of that bondage. We want to get the church back to the cleanliness that it's supposed to have and out of that corruption that has come into there. And I'd like to think that we could have an effect, that we could do something with that. It's really one of the things Youth Week is all about. Bring those guys in here, make a difference with them, change their lives. They help change our lives. All right. Goes on and it says this, and we'll wrap this up pretty quickly here. I've strayed a lot, but I think we've done well. Verse 24, judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. Then said some of them of Jerusalem, is not this he whom they seek to kill? Again, we're five verses. He's in the same speech that they're accusing him of being a devil. And they're saying, isn't this the guy they all want to kill? And it's just stunning. There's a blog out called The Times Watch, where they watch the New York Times. And they'll watch from administration to administration what they criticize. And, you know, something that they absolutely thought was wonderful 6 years ago now. This is the most horrible thing that's ever gone on. And they'll point out what they wrote 6 years ago when a different person was president and such. And it's just, but that's people. That's human beings. You just, if you can't put up with that, you can't be in the ministry. Jesus Christ could put up with it. It's listed in his sufferings, but he put up with it. Verse 26, but lo, he speaketh boldly, and they say nothing unto him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is the very Christ? And again, Christ, Messiah, and anointed are all the exact same thing, just three different languages. If I said anointed, I'm saying English. If I say Christ, I'm speaking Greek. If I say Messiah, I'm speaking Hebrew. Is not this the very Christ? Howbeit we know this man whence he is, but when Christ cometh, no man knoweth whence he is. Now, isn't this fascinating? The Lord pulled, for lack of a better word, I'm going to call it a stunt. The Lord pulled a stunt here in the birth of Jesus Christ. Where is he supposed to be born? Bethlehem. Okay. What lineage is he to come out of? The lineage of David. And you go through all these things. Could God have done more to have obscured that stuff at his birth than what he did? Instead of publicizing it, he obscured it. He had a guy from Nazareth go for the taxing to Bethlehem and have the baby and then send him off to Egypt for 2 years. How many people kept track of that? Button, who's got the button, okay? And so all these things are done. Now let me just say this. There are two types of ways that people tried to figure out how Jesus Christ, who Jesus Christ was, whether or not he's the Messiah. Some of them sought to look at what we call antecedents. Who's your daddy? Who's your mama? Where'd you come from? Where were you born? And they looked for it in that sense, the fleshly ways. As far as I can tell, none of them ever got saved. But there's others. The officers were sent to arrest him. They came back without him. The Pharisees said, you didn't arrest him. They said, no man ever spake like this man spake. Okay. The people who heard his words and judged him according to his words are in heaven today. The people who were looking for these other things never got saved. I have found the same parallel with the King James Bible. People who only look at it through manuscript evidence and language and all that never get it straight. They can never come to a conclusion on it. But when you look at it just from the words of what it says, you get it. Only God could have done this. He's the only one who could have made something this perfect. How it all came about, God will reveal to us in time. Okay? How this man speaking to us, we know whence he is. Not really, you think you know whence he is. Okay? But you don't really know whence he is. You don't really understand because Luke hasn't written his gospel yet. Okay? The book of Acts hasn't written, all these things haven't been written yet, so you don't have a clue what's he really, you just think you do. But if you're trying to look at it from that sense, you're not going to get it. You're either going to listen to the words he says, or you're not going to get it. All right. Let's go ahead and close. Father, I thank you for what we've learned this morning. I do pray. Bless the house of God. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, I pray. Amen.